Let's see, catch people up today, because you were here Tuesday? Okay. So what we discussed yesterday was a sense of place. And we talked about how memories and things are usually centered in a certain place. And different writers have dealt with that differently. And how to talk about a place. You can first give a physical description. For instance, Holden Village. Can you give us a brief physical description without looking? For memory. Just in two sentences.
In two sentences?
Yeah.
Surrounded by mountains of great splendor, beauty, rugged. That's one sentence.
And counting.
Which encodes beautifully structured homes or buildings which are designed for this area. Mm-hmm. And for this area only. So what type of buildings are there? It's been so beautiful here.
Okay, great.
Needs to be polished. It needs to be polished over. Is that enough? That's two sentences.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's
all you know about it. Yeah.
My son teaches at Art Heritage College on the reservation.
Oh, Indian Heritage College.
Yeah. I'll have to get your address.
Okay.
If I can find one of his cards,
can I pay a piece of paper up for this table?
So, are you here? You're here or there?
That's the way. Yeah. Where are you?
Did you let us write stuff?
Right, yeah, I
you're the one.
And, encouraged
and
you.
We read three or four of them, right?
No, no one read anything.
That was another class.
What?
It's a autobiography.
It was family history things of our childhood.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. That sounds very similar.
That was what we, I wasn't sure. It was one of the,
Right brain, left brain.
Yeah, okay.
And we had cluster thinking.
Yeah, okay. And then I haven't been back to right brain, left brain since, I guess. So, anyway, so I wrote this about an incident in my childhood.
Well, maybe you can read it later. Okay. We're kind of reviewing what we did yesterday, and then we talked about another part of history, which is the cultural or anthropological, or depending on how much history there is in an area. So. Holden Village also had a cultural history. Mark, you know a little bit about, you were saying the other day about the first, the Native first, peoples who...
The Native American people have used this as a passageway between Eastern and Western Washington for the tribal people. A lot of them would barter between the different tribes. Fish from the west, from the coastal area, and clams and oysters, and they would get meats and other meats and other berries from this side of the mountains. And normally they would travel back and forth through the Lake of Chelan. To get to the northern part of the Washington State as a passageway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that went back how many years?
Oh, probably 300, 400 years back.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They say the by anthropologists, the Northwest Native American people they have it between 12,000 and 17,000 years old, depending on who you talk to, for the Northwest tribes. No, just coastal tribes.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are you now, Snohomish?
Skokomish.
That's Skokomish.
Yeah. That's K-O. M-I-S-H.
M-I-N.
S-H.
S-H.
Snohomish is his name.
Snohomish.
Name of that town.
A lot of the names of our tribes depicted the, more or less the area we were from. We were called the Freshwater Tribe.
Freshwater?
Freshwater Tribe.
For what part of water?
From the name of our river.
The river?
Was, the Freshwater Tribe. Mish is the word for people in the Coastal Salish language.
Okay, so...
That's why you see Mish on, a lot of the last of the names. And then like Snohomish would be like the, for actually the, like the high hills, high mountain people.
Now is that, Snohomish, is that a part of the Salish people?
Salish, Coastal Salish.
Pretty much the whole coast.
Whole coast.
The whole coast, the Puget Sound area was inhabited by the coastal Salish, all that could be British Columbia.
British Columbia down toward northern, most of Oregon, western Oregon.
Yeah, so anyway, that's the anthropological or history of it, and then since sort of in between your account and your account, there was also a mining village, but so in the sense of place, you know, there are all these different things that have gone on in place, and then where does your family fit in that particular scheme? And yesterday we read Annie Dillard, who wrote about Pittsburgh, growing up in Pittsburgh, and how it was, I guess, originally Pittsburgh was not settled like the other parts of the East Coast. It was just nothing. And then it also said there weren't even any Native peoples there. It was kind of a
strange,
unusual account.
You know, we decided. The confluence of three rivers coming in, Ohio and the Monongahela and Allegheny, I guess. If those three come in, there must have been Indians there in the 1700s.
But they claimed there were, she's claimed there weren't. The first person there was George Washington. But anyway, I'm just saying, when she does her memoir, she starts way back and then kind of builds forward, so it gives you an idea of what was going on in this place.
Well, she also said there were parakeets there.
Yeah, North Carolina.
I don't think there was parakeets.
But Annie Dillard is known for, you know,
flowering and
taking liberties. But anyway, and then we also read a little bit from this William Kitteridge book on Eastern Oregon. And he kind of skips around a bit too. But the point is, there are so many ways to talk about place. And I talked a little bit about place in my book. And also then the other thing I was going into yesterday was location and history. And that kind of fits in with what I'm going to do today, is talk about how to find out materials.
This is one you wrote.
This is one I wrote. Now, one of the more interesting places to find information for me was back in Washington, D.C., writing to get war records. The war records are available to any person in the United States. If you had a relative it probably doesn't even have to be a relative, but if you request and you know the person's full name, and the best thing you can know is their regiment or what state they were located in, and they will send you a full history almost of their being in the military, you know, mustering in and mustering out and the whole business. And so that was interesting. And then the second part of it is they'll send you the pension records if the person was on a pension. And in my case, I had a relative that was in the Civil War, and they had a pension, but in order to get the pension, it was a widow's pension after he died, and then she had to prove that she was married to this individual. So there were all these affidavits saying, was he in fact married to her? And then of course you get these relatives who say, yes, he was, and we didn't like her, and you know, really interesting stuff, you know. because I guess in this case, the relative, he had remarried and it was, you know, a stepmother and didn't, you know, back then, that didn't go over that well in this case anyway. But anyway, so I found out all about the Civil War stuff and it was real interesting. And I thought I would read a little bit of it because it might interest some of you here of Norwegian ancestry, because I'm talking about my great-great-grandfather, Carl Torbensen. Okay, Carl came to the United States from Telemark on May 25th of 1858. His father, Ole Torbensen, was a schoolkeeper from Oms until he married in 1829 and moved to his wife's family farm. Ole and Ann had seven children in Solund, and if these names sound like I'm not pronouncing them right, forgive me.
But,
okay. Outlaw, Torborn, Johannes, Gunnild, Halvor, Cal, and Svenning, I guess.
That'd be Torbjorn.
Torbjorn, don't pronounce the B.
Is it J there?
Yeah.
Torbjorn.
Okay, anyway. Before immigrating to the United States on March 4th, 1847, they settled in one of the earliest Norwegian settlements, Muskego, Wisconsin. Yeah. Cal was only 4 years old. 14 years later, Cal was changed to Carl, enrolled as a volunteer in the 15th Regiment, Wisconsin. The Norwegian troops, under Colonel Haig and Captain John...
Is that H-E-G?
H-E-G.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have an indirect relative of Haig who's Norwegian descent.
Oh, so you're Norwegian too?
No, it's my cousin in California.
You're a League of Nations, aren't you?
Well, I'm not Norwegian, but my cousin Phil Haig down in La Jolla. His father was Norwegian, and his father was Ernest Haig, H-E-G, so that's interesting.
Okay, Colonel Haig and Captain John T. Rice's Company C on November 22nd, 1861. Haig, by the way, a lot of this information I found out from history books, so some of it from Washington, D.C., and then some of it from history books. Haig was like a father to the young soldiers. 95% of them spoke only Norwegian. And some spoke only a little English. So you can imagine what, you know, this troop fighting the Civil War and they're all speaking Norwegian. Must have just been. And
how did they say that in Norwegian? Forward march.
I don't know, maybe it comes up. They call themselves the Heligolats Musketeeren. Do you speak any Norwegian?
Very little.
Oh, okay.
I can pronounce it better than I can speak it.
Well, anyway, it sounds like the Musketeers. I don't know. Anyway, Haig himself was the son of a pioneer of the Muskego settlement. So he inspired his fellow Norwegians to band together, this is a quote, band together and deliver untarnished to posterity the old and honorable name of Norseman. Carl entered the war as a drummer boy. And this is a very interesting part of the Civil War history, is they started out with muskets, which is, as you know, they're a very inaccurate firing weapon. You have to stand in a line and then all fire at once in order to hit anything. So it's not real accurate. And that's why the drummer boy was real important, because, you know, when they drum, then bing. So anyway, so the first part of the war.
That's why they had the drummer boy.
Yeah, you know, first part of the war, the musket was still in use, and due to its inaccuracy, troops lined up and fired to the beat of a drum. Later, when the single fire carbine was put to use, the drummer and the trumpet were no longer necessary, and Carl took up a rifle. So then the single fire, I guess you use some kind of ramrod.
Single shot.
Fired and supposed to be.
Were they ramrods?
I don't.
Bullets were coming in.
Something like that, yeah. Anyway, it became much more accurate. Mm-hmm. And they could fire at an object instead of just blindly into the space. Mm-hmm. Okay. Colonel Haig's men celebrated the 17th of May, which is Norwegian Independence Day, from Danish rule, And on one occasion, they celebrated a bit too much. And a few zealous patriots were court-martialed the very next day.
Not each other.
Well, we know what that probably meant. Okay, in the fall of 1861, while heading south, the troops stopped at Chicago in the Nora Lodge, and Haig was presented with a flag with stripes and an emblem on which was the Norwegian lion and the words "For Gud og vor land."
Or for God and
our country.
Yeah.
For God and country, yeah.
God and country, good, yeah. God and country.
Uh-huh. So the 15th Wisconsin participated in over 25 different battles during the war, and Carl, who was shot 3 times, participated in 17 of them, including Union City, Perryville, Stones River, Missionary Ridge, Rocky Face, New Hope, and so on.
He didn't lose any limbs?
He didn't, but he did, well, I'll go into that later, but he did suffer from it, yeah. And he did get a pension from that. Chickamauga was where the 15th lost its beloved leader, Haig, Colonel Haig. When on September 19th, 1863, the Norwegians were given the dangerous position of defending the main road. Now this is quite, I guess, an honor to be put in such a dangerous spot, but Colonel Haig was shot in the stomach and died the next day. So the 15th stayed until the bitter end, however, retreating only when they were shot from the rear. At Chickamauga, Carl received, quote, a gunshot wound in the right arm below the elbow, which carried away a portion of the bone and severed the cords of the right arm. So this was in the records that I received, exactly what the injury was. He said that later, despite his injuries, he would just take a big swig of whiskey and then go on with the battle. So I don't know.
It sounds like the movies.
Yeah.
Like Rocky.
That's what you used to do when I had wounds, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was just Norwegians.
No.
It's okay.
Usually, when those bullets hit the main bone, you know, they just lop it off.
Yeah.
They're shattered and they couldn't do anything.
Terrible suffering, terrible pain.
I guess he was lucky then, really.
What year was that, or what years?
1861 is when they lost their. They started in it, and then in 1863 they lost Colonel Haig. After this injury, he was hospitalized in Nashville for a week, and then transferred to a hospital in Madison, Indiana. After Haig died in Chickamauga, Major Johnson, second in command, was taken prisoner. And there were only 75 men who were present in roll call after Chickamauga. One of the bloodiest battles in the Civil War, at which there fell at least an estimated 32,000 men. That's a really severe one. Major Johnson was put into the Libby prison and then transferred by train to the notoriously inhumane Andersonville prison.
Oh.
He and two others escaped, though, by burrowing themselves between the tracks until the train passed over. They still had miles to reach the north, however, and traveled by night to avoid detection. They stopped at a cabin of a black family, hoping to find sanctuary, telling them that they were fighting to, we're coming to help free you, but the blacks knew little about the war and less about its cause. Flustered, they said, the young master was away. Another time they stopped at the home of a southern woman whose husband was off fighting for the South. She expressed disillusionment about the war because it was a rich man's war. After Carl left the hospital, he was promoted to corporal. He mustered out December 31st, 1864. His family had then moved to Christiana, which now I guess... Christiana, Minnesota.
Oh.
That's
from
Oslo, Minnesota.
There is an Oslo, Minnesota.
There is an Oslo, Minnesota.
A Norwegian community south of Minneapolis, and there he met.
That's not it.
It's a very small little farm town.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And just the same war.
That was way back in
the Christiana?
Yeah. It's,
over 130 years ago, it's probably non-existent.
There he met Ann Nelson, who was born... Osney, Nielsen, Rowland, Telemark, and anyway. So that was about the place, the event, which was so
The Norwegian bunch getting the Gettysburg?
They were in 17 different places, and it doesn't say Gettysburg.
Sounds like they were kind of on the Western campaign.
But they sent you all, did you know any of this before, you sent for that?
No, absolutely not, no.
That's really something to get that much information.
Well, like I said, I also used a history book. There's been several history books that are just about the Norwegian participation. So I kind of used the specific information about Carl and then fit that in with the... See, if you figure if he's with this troop, then he must have experienced what they experienced, so...
They were from Wisconsin.
It's not for public, you haven't published this.
No, I'm trying, but...
Trying to get, yeah.
It's not...
Could you make copies of those pages that refer to Colonel Haig?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I could send them to you. Yeah, they don't have a copy machine up here, but sure.
They don't have a copy machine?
Yeah, there is.
Publish that.
There is?
Up in the office, that we
should.
Oh, I didn't know that.
For free.
Yeah, they just ask for 10 cents a copy.
Well, they want 10 cents a copy?
Great.
Well, I'll give you 10 cents a copy for it.
Okay.
If you take it to Madison, Wisconsin, they'll probably see if it would get published.
Yeah, well, I've tried quite a few places, but... I have a picture of young Cal.
Now, you're a descendant, direct descendant of this Colonel Haig?
Colonel Haig, no. Cal. Here is a young little Cal at 17 years old going off to the Civil War in his little drummer boy outfit, I guess.
He surely looks young.
Yeah.
Cal's in the family, huh? That photograph.
Yeah, they some of the family kept it.
How's he related to you?
Well, he's my great-great-grandfather.
Well, you're on direct descent then.
Well, no, but he's not related. He was just fighting with him. He was with the troops.
Oh, I see. He was with Colonel Haig.
Yeah, Colonel Haig. Yeah, that would be, you know.
Colonel Haig.
How they would allow young 17-year-old boys to go in there as drummers, because they were just this...
They were younger than that,
and they were just as vulnerable to being shot as anybody else.
Well, I couldn't figure out, I mean, you just come to this country, and then a few years later, you're here fighting in the war for a country you just got to.
You don't speak English.
You don't even speak English, and then, you know, there's this pride in doing
this. Well, I was going to say, they were prompt.
And then I've heard some of the people who came to this country were come here to resist the draft in Europe, you know, and then they come here, and right into it.
Those were volunteers, too.
Everyone, yeah.
But the Minnesota regiment that went got into battle in Gettysburg, there was a famous regiment there in the Lalamar buried at Gettysburg. Mm-hmm. There were a bunch of Norwegians. You look at the
names. I saw that when we were there. That's what I was going to say. Yeah. That was Minnesota. I suppose each state probably, but you're right. I saw that air section too, and a lot of Scandinavians in that one. Mm-hmm. But I don't think it was just Norwegian.
No.
There were mostly Norwegians living there at the time, or Scandinavians, I think.
I grew up in North Dakota, but then I had an idea there were nothing but Norwegians and Lutherans in the world.
Well, see, I did too. Yeah. Our world was so small. That's funny, but I feel like we grew up in those little Scandinavian communities, and you did.
The whole of America was Scandinavian.
Well, you figured that they should have been. Everybody was a Viking.
Oh.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. This part, I went through, you mentioned this in North Dakota. I went through North Dakota about 4 years ago to do some research for this. Mm-hmm. And I passed, you know where Mayville, yeah. North Dakota is? It's kind of...
close to Reagan.
Yeah, near Minnesota border,
right.
But south of Fargo.
I suppose there's a crow flies about 40 miles.
And anyway, I was driving on the interstate, and I passed a sign that was kind of interesting. It said there are 70,156 Lutherans living within 50 miles of this sign. And here you are, and it was... There was nothing. No towns. I couldn't even believe there was 10 people living on that sign.
I've never seen a sign like that. That's pretty bad.
Where is that? Where is that sign from?
Well, okay, you're going after, you're coming into Mayville from Fargo, you know, going south on the interstate.
You're on Highway 200.
Maybe it's not still there, it was still there about four years ago.
I haven't been on the freeway.
No.
You didn't put it up, huh?
No. I apologize.
They must have come to graveyard soon.
See, that's when you get along, you go.
And they're still working anyway. That they can't change, huh?
There's still a lot of them there, yeah.
Yeah, that's.
Isolated.
70,000?
70,000, and I mean.
There isn't a big.
You can go, it seems like hundreds of miles on roads in North Dakota, not even see a house.
It's possible.
Maybe they're living in dugouts.
Within how far?
Oh, actually, that's pretty well for farmers.
Within how far?
Within 50 miles of this side.
50?
Well, that is.
Well, that takes them over to Minnesota too.
Yeah, true, yeah.
Across the Red River.
Could be, yeah, it's a 50 square miles.
It wouldn't include Fargo, that's farther.
No, that'd be more, that'd even be more.
They include the big town of Atlanta, North Dakota.
Yeah, that's what I said, there aren't even any big towns, maybe a few hundred people in each one of those little towns in that part of the country. It is kind of interesting though how, well, I guess most of the Scandinavians did settle in Wisconsin, North Dakota, Minnesota, because they were looking for big farmlands, that's why they left the old country in the first place.
There were an awful lot of them left.
Yeah, because.
They all came to Washington.
The oldest son in the family appeared and everything, and the rest of them knew they were never going to have a chance.
They all came to Boulder.
They all came to Boulder.
A lot of living there.
They should have told us all if they were in Boulder place.
Woodburn Senior Estates is about half.
What is?
Woodburn Senior Estates in Oregon is about half Scandinavian.
Well, they're all over those Vikings, you know.
Those Vikings, even, yeah.
They were all over.
Well, now I'm going to say a few places where I got information, because that's the topic tonight. And feel free to bring in your own personal ideas on this, because these were things, they're specific to what I was doing, which was mostly these Midwestern.
Kind of what did you start, well, you started with your own family and had some people in your family already done some of the groundwork, did you?
Yes, absolutely.
What the family tree looked like?
Yeah, my mother is a great storyteller. And my father was very interested in genealogy, trees and all that.
You're lucky then.
Yeah, so they complemented each other's work, and then I basically just wrote it down.
Were your four grandparents all living when you were working on this?
Oh, no, all gone. Yeah, that was part of the reason I did it too, is because I never knew my father's parents. And I certainly never knew their parents, or, you know, I did not know a lot of people, being the youngest of a family of four, and a lot of the history was.
That's the disadvantage about being the youngest, which I have, family of.
Yeah.
There were nine kids, two of them died as boys. But my oldest brother, Paul, went to St. Olaf College, did a kind of extensive research on this kind of thing. And around the Northfield, and then he got over to Fargo, relatives all in southern Minnesota. He personally interviewed them, I bet it took him a year to do it.
Yeah.
And he wrote that up as a.
That'd be interesting, yeah.
So I got all that to look at.
Right, that's very good, those interviews are, yeah, those personal interviews, you can't really replace those with, you know, anything else. Now, first of all, starting at the highest, the most general thing is, of course, you know, your United States histories or histories of Norway or wherever in Europe, those are your most general. And then every state has quite a few histories, I found, like Minnesota had quite a few histories. The one I used was William Falwell, I found was an excellent one, I think there's like four volumes to it. And then there's a history of North Dakota, there's a history of Washington State, and most all of these are helpful for very general information. Then further on down, I found each county generally had a history. For instance, in Minnesota, I did a lot of work on Goodhue County, and what was that? Otter Tail County, And it's just, you know, each county had a history that was.
They all have their historical societies.
Mm-hmm, and published, yeah, by the historical or by the state. So those I found, and then some towns had histories, others didn't. But I found particularly the bigger towns would have histories, and for the smaller towns, it might be in the county histories. Then there are, like I said, war histories for those kinds of information. Another thing I used a lot was the history of the church. There's a very good book, it's called Who's Who Among All the Norwegian Lutheran Synods of America. Of course, that's very specific. If you don't happen to come from that type of background, then perhaps in your other religions there are similar types of things, or ethnic type things.
Did you go to the LDS libraries?
Yeah, at one point I got stuck on this Carl Torbenson, and I sent the thing with the Mormon Church is that they do charge, and for instance, if you're looking for something that's hard to find, they charge you to.
Research, go, I suppose.
Yeah, an hourly fee.
You go there yourself.
Yeah, you can go there yourself.
Yeah, but it's a long way.
We have quite
library.
A few in Billings, actually, yeah. And they've been advertising a group that meets. They didn't say anything about
it. All they charge you for the Mormon Library in Salt Lake City is the copies that you make.
Yeah, if you can. It's a long ways away.
But you have to
if
have
you
a
do
long
the
time
research,
to
you can
there.
Take
and
out
you
the microfilms,
yeah.
And if you know how to use computers, you take them.
Complete.
Yeah, but it is a resource. If you can write to them, and they will, it depends on what ethnic group you're looking at. They will do the research for you, and then send it back to you for a fee. Yeah, I had just a one little tiny thing, and then I did run into a couple dead ends, but they were helpful for one relative. Then, of course, there are newspapers, which are so wonderful. We go back in time, and boy, these newspapers can be incredibly gossipy. You know, they little Yeah, I found this one grandfather. He was living in a town called Towner, North Dakota, and it's a town maybe about 100 people. And they had a newspaper, and it was like, you know, Johannes Copperdahl stopped by today to show, you know, his tomatoes from his garden. And boy, were they big!
They almost couldn't get them through the door.
Yeah, and so-and-so went to town, Fargo.
I've got to research something. Something
you learned from
Fargo. They haven't changed much over the years.
I'm trying to research something from my old hometown where when I was in first grade, our first Christmas tree party in old 1921, and the candles, old newfangled lights in those days. And the teacher was lighting them, the tree had been standing there a week, and all of a sudden the whole thing was ablaze. And she drags that thing up, and part of the back end of her dress, and then she somehow got around trying to push it through. And meanwhile, a couple of those guys went and got the janitor who was coming for. Mm-hmm. You know what he did? He came to the other side, threw it at the tree, and Miss Thompson was on the other side of the tree, so blessed.
I know.
That's a comedy of errors, the whole thing, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then
superintendent
was there, and they were trying to put the fire out. He's the guy who was always made sure that, and he took pride in emptying the whole building in just 3 minutes, and I forgot to ring the gong while there was a genuine fire going. Well, I'm trying to research that and find that story in the old history.
So as an example, my mother lived in Chihuahua, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now you'd go to Chihuahua and go through their newspaper archives, that kind of thing?
Yeah, generally for those newspapers, I'm not sure. There's a lot you can do through interlibrary loan. And like you mentioned, Missouri, you probably can find in any big library a good history of that, and maybe it will have a bibliography in the back, and then you can look and see if there's anything specific to that town or that county. And then you could possibly get books through interlibrary loan. As far as I know, newspapers, a lot of the times you'll have to go.
Yeah, I
back there. Like, I had to go back to Minnesota and just, you know.
What they call it, the morgue, don't they?
They call it the morgue, and you go down the basement, and it's dark, and it's dingy. And
how long do they keep them? That's what I was wondering.
They keep, these were 18.
Then they usually.
They did send me some from North Dakota through interlibrary loan. Some of the old newspapers, but you, there is an index of all the newspapers that they have in libraries at a good research library, and you can look it up. The only thing about the newspaper I was looking, it wasn't under the town that I was looking for. It's under a different town, but you can look under the state. And then you can go down the list and see something that might be similar. And like the ones I got were from 1888. And I got them through interlibrary loan on those rolls, microfiche or microfilm. Mm-hmm. And then I could use them for a couple of weeks, and then I had to send them back. But that's a resource you can use for newspapers. Hi, Bobby. And I, yeah, sure, come join us. So that's a very, very good resource that not too many people know about.
Would you, is that kind of thing available for, was that North Dakota you're talking about?
It's for anywhere in the United States.
Yeah.
And it's, you go to the librarian and say, where's, it's a volume about that thick, and it's got all the newspapers that would be on, available through.
Okay, what library are you seeing to go to?
Well, I would say, the biggest one in your area, because it's kind of a, you know, it's probably going to be small.
Our local area, I don't think they'd have it.
Like a regional, maybe.
You could point in the right direction. Yeah. We're in Minnesota, well,
North. You're in Minnesota. How about, do you live near Minneapolis at all? Or
125 miles from there.
Yeah. Or
this is stories from North Dakota I'm trying to find.
Uh-huh.
Would they have that?
Well, newspapers?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. They would have this. Like I'm saying, it's a volume. It has a list of each newspaper they would have on microfilm or that you could get through interlibrary loan. And then you would save you a trip. And it's great because, you know, even if you went there, you wouldn't have that much time to continually go through.
Do you have the title of that magazine? That book?
It's something like American. I'm sure a reference librarian would
know.
Okay. It's a volume. Has all newspapers that are on microfilm, specifically for that, in the United States. And thank you for bringing that up. Forgot about that one. And that's how I did a lot of my research. Then other papers that aren't on microfilm, they can't be sent. But there's a lot that are on microfilm. Like I said, the one I had was from 1888, and is in this very small town in Minnesota, in North Dakota.
I think it'd be amazing if the newspapers in that little town, North Dakota, they could find them stored someplace.
Mm-hmm.
It, of course, they'd be almost rotted apart too.
Well, that's why, they put them on microfilm because they would be so fragile. Okay, so that's the state regional histories, and then the church histories. For those of you that are of Norwegian background, there's a very good book, but it's all Norwegian, but it doesn't really matter because it's just very detailed about anyone that came to the United States from Norway who did something of note. And it's called the Norse Americaners Festskrift.
Well, I got
my dad. Uh-huh. And let's see what else. Yeah, and a lot of the stuff is in, you know, if it's in a foreign language, then you're going to have to go through the translations and things like that. So, okay.
The history of the Lutheran Church, though, if you're interested in that, you know, I have a two-volume set written by a professor at the seminary. And it takes the old ELC, or the old Norwegian Lutheran Church in America, and the Lutheran Free Church, and some others, and it tells about them coming into the merger. And it's very detailed.
That is very interesting.
And even way back in the 1890s, two churches merged together, and then they split because of differences. They even had lawsuits.
Now, there are a lot of articles in what they call these magazines, Historical Quarterly. Most states have a historical society that put out these magazines every month or every four times quarterly, right? For instance, there's one, the North Dakota Historical Quarterly, which was very good, and they have articles there. And so basically that is those types of information, which I call the library part of your work. And then there's the interview part of your work. And that's kind of fun, because a lot of you have talked about oral histories and how you go about doing that. And recently we had an exhibit at the Portland Library called, it was Family Folklore, the Multnomah Public Library. And it was kind of interesting. And they gave guidelines on how to start this sort of thing. They said the first thing you should start with is, they asked the question, your oldest relative, the one you feel most at ease with, who would you guess who you should start with?
The one you feel more at ease with? No?
The oldest one would be your grandparents.
Yeah,
but you don't want to still
be. No? It says the place to begin with is yourself.
Yeah,
right.
I'm gonna go backwards.
Because you are part of your family, and says you should ask yourself the questions that you really want to know. This is your what you're doing, and you have may be interested in some things more than others. You may be terribly interested in legends and oral histories, or you may be more interested in facts and dates and genealogies and things like that. So it should start with yourself, and I think that's the most important part of that, is that it gives the what you're writing a lot of more interest, because you are living and breathing human being, and you're living right now, and what are the things that are interesting to people right now. Okay, then once you're figure those sorts of things out, then you will probably want to start interviewing other people. So they suggest that you could bring a tape recorder as a tool. It says, you know, this is what most people will do. Others, you know, don't want to. I myself don't. I kind of like writing things down. It's kind of difficult to, when you get a tape home, to start, you know, working from it. So I write things down, but I'm sure a lot of people prefer tape recordings. The first thing to do is, you know, to make the person feel at ease. And if you want to mention that you have a tape recorder and see how they feel about that, and if they don't mind that, then, you know, that's fine. But it suggests that you might want to start with a topic that will get the person going, like a story from the past that you've heard about the person, just to get them feeling comfortable. So, and then also give the relative confidence in their ability to contribute. It says that, number two, avoid generalities. Don't say, okay, could you tell me a little bit about yourself? Because that, you know, where do you go? And it says often what happens in that case is they just give you some names and dates. So it's best if you have any specific details to get going on those. Then it says to ask evocative questions. Nothing can kill an interview faster than a long series of questions that require only yes or no answers. So back to the stories again. I think everyone's a natural born storyteller, and those are the things you want. You're kind of dependent on what you can get. They may not know what you want, but try to get what they have to offer, and trust that later that will fit into what you're doing. And if they don't want to tell you something, you know, you can't push it exactly. I mean, everyone has things that they don't want to say, but you should, you know, get a sense of trust and approach it that way. And then another thing that might happen during an interview is there may be some role changing. In other words, you're interviewing your mother, or you're interviewing your son or whatever. You're becoming in charge, and they're may used to being in charge, but now you're in charge. So that is, if the person's older, now you're in charge. So there's a change of role. And the other thing is just show interest, you know. That's, you don't want to sit there and go to sleep or something, but but they may get off on tangents, so you'd have to direct them back. This is, I think, a very important one, is to know what you're going to ask. Have a list. You may not sit there and just read it down, but like I said, people can get extremely sidetracked. Now, I know it's happened to me, but if you have a list sitting there of what the specific things that you want to ask, then you can always go back to that. And then you don't go away, you know, having come 1,000 miles and going, oh no, I forgot to ask the main thing or something.
I think it would be important to make sure you got plenty of time.
Yeah, but you'll find a lot of people get tired after about an hour. So yeah, you could arrange for other interviews, but it's good to have things down.
Did you have a goal in terms of, you know, how much you wanted, how far back, or
Yeah, I think it's very necessary to have a specific
time frame
and a specific goal or a theme for each chapter, and not to get digress. It's very confusing to people. Family histories can be very confusing because there's so much movement and different relatives coming in, and it gets kind of confusing. So I realized, since I live in this country, I was not going to worry about the old country. That's another research project. I thought I would start the minute they got to this country. Then whatever they did, that was what I was going to do. And I cut it off with my grandparents. I didn't go into my mother and father. Or myself, really, but
you get into uncles and cousins or anything like that.
Not really, if they related to their. But that's just me. I mean, I'm now working on part two, where my father. So, you know, but for this particular thing, I cut it off with the grandparents.
And your father's living now?
No, he's not. So, he's fair game. I'm sorry. I mean, there is a problem, I mean, dealing with relatives, as you might guess. There is a part in here where my mother, she has not showed it to any of her relatives, because she...
Your mother's still living.
My mother's still living, yes. So, I mean, you can get into some hot water here.
There's some black sheep in the family, too.
Well, it wasn't really
come out as your research usually.
It wasn't really black sheep in her case. It was that my mother is from, her mother was German and her father was Norwegian. So but they were both Lutheran. But for some reason, the Germans felt my grandmother, that was German, felt that the Norwegians weren't quite, you know,
really
up to snuff.
So
probably she was right.
So
I've heard of Germans too.
But they were both Lutheran. That's how they got together. So. But the Germans, you know, they were the original Lutherans.
Sure,
so
sure.
That's true. I never thought of it that way.
Well, my mother found out.
Norway's the holy land, though.
Yeah.
off the top of my head.
We try to keep it in the clamp.
So, as a consequence, my, you know, hearing this, that the Germans are always superior, you know, she, you know, and I put it in the book, and she said, well, she can't show it to any of her relatives, because she'd be too...
She'd have an uprising.
Yeah.
Now, if you have a friend, a relative who's alcoholic, you know, and they've gotten help and so forth, but I can't leave that out.
No, you gotta put that in.
Specifically, I'm thinking of a brother of mine, you know.
Yeah, you gotta put that in.
Dentist, a very good dentist, but he was alcoholic.
Family members and...
Not alcoholic, but he's gotten a hold of the thing now with that.
Oh, yeah, I've got a couple of them here.
I can't leave it out there, but I don't wanna show it to him, or his kids.
Oh, that's true, yeah. Well, yeah, you think, well, how can you say that in a nice way, you know? Tendency to drink too much.
I don't think I would get specific.
But anyway, so...
What was the name of the whole book that you have there? Is that something that just came with, from that library, or is that available?
Yeah, I don't know if this is available anywhere. It came with this exhibit.
Oh, I see.
But there are quite a few books that are on this subject. So, now it says, don't turn off the tape recorder unless you're asked to. Because if you turn it off in the middle of the interview, they think, uh-oh, maybe I said something that wasn't too interesting or something. Okay, but that's pretty obvious. It says bring props if you have them, including...
Pictures.
Photographs, letters, scrapbooks, home movies, documents, furniture. But whatever you can that can bring out memories. A lot of times, memories are hinged to things that you can see. A cup, maybe. I interviewed somebody that had been a very young girl and came over and lived with my grandparents, and she had a cup there that was from my grandfather, and it was very meaningful to her. She said when they had used to drink coffee, and of course, being Norwegian, it was all the time. So it was something that can really personalize and make a warm conversation. It said to be sensitive to the needs of the family members, and so schedule the interview at a convenient time. And it says people tire easily, so don't put people out, also once you're finished with the interview is to write it down and send them what you found out or what they said. I think that's good policy, you know, so that they know that they aren't going down in infamy or anything. And label everything very carefully. So now there's, like, anything that you're going to publish, say you're going to publish this stuff, you have to be sensitive to copyright regulations. This includes letters and journals, diaries, memoirs, anything like that. You have to kind of get permission or whoever the writer is and the recipient. I'm not sure. Bob, you're a writer.
You have to ask them for permission.
Yeah, you've got to be very careful about that. If they're living, yeah.
What about newspapers? All newspapers, not living, think so. Aren't they kind of public?
What's the law on publishing quotations from... is there a limit?
But like in a business.
You do have to put it in your bibliography, any of these types of things, even letters.
Coming, as far as their big dead, their husband or wife, then they have ownership of those things.
The letters.
Because we knew, Gordon Lemire, mm-hmm. who was a boyfriend of the famous woman poet Sylvia Plath, and she died, and... he had letters from her or something, but he couldn't publish them without the permission of her later husband.
Yeah, he's still living.
So you have to get written permission from, like, if you're interviewing these at the time, or how do you, I wonder?
Okay, says here.
Well, I'm just curious.
Yeah. Before publishing the diaries, memoirs, letters, or other written artifacts, you would be wise to find out copyright regulations. The writer of a letter owns the copyright, not the recipient.
There's a thing.
Okay, that's the thing. So if you receive a bunch of letters from Aunt Mabel, she tells you all this great stuff about the family, this means she still really owns this stuff if it's going to be published.
The person that wrote the letter, right?
The person that wrote it, yeah. Even if you have it sitting there in your desk and you think, ah, this is mine, I can do whatever I want.
And then what?
Would you make sure you get written permission from that person? Probably wouldn't be a bad idea.
Yeah. The copyright office, yeah, is located in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, you know, the regulations. Yeah.
And that's in...
But if great aunt Millie is dead,
yeah,
does the ownership of those letters descend to her children, grandchildren?
I would have to think that something like that. Otherwise, there might be some major embarrassments or something. It's a good law to protect you.
Well, forget the husband. He's been dead for 75 years.
Okay, I don't know about that.
I'm talking about the children and grandchildren.
Isn't there some law that after about 75 years, everything's fair game?
Yeah.
Yeah.
After 75 years after...
those are pretty old letters, though.
Everything becomes public domain.
So until that time,
so it
would
be around 1920 or so. I mean, that's 73 years ago, 1918.
Yeah.
1915 is 77 years. I know because that's what my age is.
Well, do you have the U.S. Copyright Office?
Years, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I do have that address. I'll give that to you.
That they have exact laws about it.
Yeah. Okay, so the same principle holds true for tape-recorded interviews. The speaker, not the tape owner, holds the rights to the material. So you're interviewing Aunt Mabel, you get it all down, then you need permission. And that is if you publish it. It's if you make it into something like I've done for the family, you don't need to do that. However, it's a very wise idea to write it all down and make a complete bibliography and get that permission just in case it does get published, because you don't know. And so that's what I've done. I've just, you know, everything I do, it's got this little notation, the date, the person who did the work, and then the place and all that, just in case.
And what's that address?
The address is Copyright Office, Library of Congress, Washington, D.C., 20540. And that's
it. Say that again.
That's Copyright Office, Library of Congress, Washington, D.C., 20540. So. Well,
hey,
you didn't. Yeah, you're welcome.
Oh,
I hope,
great.
Hope to see your family history's published soon.
75 years or so.
And then send it to the whole library.
8,000 years.
I'm going back, I'll have mine published by maybe November.
That's right.
Are you familiar with the Chippewas?
I know a little bit of it. We have a woman on part of our... I work with Native American Tax Records, which is Conway, Seattle, and one of our co-chairs is Chippewa.
I found out some really...
Finding out the history of...
All the churches there have things all the way back.
They do, but they're again.
So our family has it all the way back to like 1200 or something. Yes.
Down by...
and that somebody did that part of the work already. But that work is so... I couldn't even begin to do it.
Oh, my wife says I gotta go.
Well.
Oh, I know the date.
Late for the service.
Vespers.
Vespers.
Thank you.
We're off.
Yeah, thank you for coming.
Meeting tomorrow again?
What?
What is the name of your trial again?
Tomorrow, I'm Monday day off.
Scope, you'll be around. Margie was curious.
Yeah, I'll be around. I'll be back to see.